Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who had nearly 5 hours sleep last night and feels that was a lot. It's Richard Herring! I tell you what, you're much better than last week's audience. They were cunts. Cunts. So welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was opening a bank account at the Gyro Bank. Open your bank account. Britain is the national Gyro Bank. You get a chequebook and everything. And the woman served me, she called it Rella. I don't know if that's going to catch on. So yeah, I mean, it's weird being back having a 2-week-old child again. I mean, yeah, I know my child's been 2 weeks for a long time for you people at home, especially given the order we're putting these out, and you're going to be very confused. But it's just not really getting any sleep. But you kind of end up in a wonderful kind of place where you imagine everything you're saying is brilliantly funny, and flights are fancy. You just don't know. I'm not sure most of the time if I'm asleep or awake at the moment, and whether this is a dream or real. I'm presuming from the way everyone's just sitting, staring at me cross-armed, this is a dream. So it's fine. So I'm going to just put a crack on. I'm just going to get my cock out. What? No? See, I'm a modern man. That woman said no, so I will not get my cock out. That is... Are you sure? No. Just have a look at the tip and then make a decision. Then you can make a decision. Make an informed decision. I really should have a script. But it's all right. This is the dream one. This is the dream version. So we're going to be fine. I've decided to keep the jacket on. We'll see how that goes. Thank you. Yeah, it's good. This is from Debenhams. This is my. This is the suit I wear when I'm fat. I've got some really nice suits that I bought for when I was thin. I don't know why I'm looking at you. You know what I'm talking about? Right, we're brothers, mate. We're brothers. It's all good. But, you know, from a distance, it could be over. You don't, it's not been fitted to my actual leg, that, you'll notice. But that's That's how much respect I have for the man we buried today. So it's... he couldn't see. He was in a right old state. So it's... time to move on. So let's crack. I was going to talk to the audience, but I think it's just best I don't. It's best I stop. I've just had a restraining order saying I'm not allowed to talk to anyone in the front row anymore. Quite rightly so. Our guest this week is probably best known from his appearance on Die Harald Schmidt Show. That's why we're here to see him. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome John Maloney?
John, how you doing?
Oh. Should we sit?
Yes, let's sit down. Sit down and make yourself at home.
All right, okay.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Good, thank you.
What's weird about this is that I remember one of the first times I met you where we actually spent a bit of time together was about 10 years ago in Montreal.
That's right, yeah.
And when I first started in comedy, which is far too long ago, I was always quite intimidated by you.
Really?
Yeah. Because I just saw this kind of force of nature, this kind of intellectual giant of comedy and you know, somebody who could just weave gold out of shit. Funny shit, obviously. And then when I met you, I realised you just looked the same as the rest of us.
Yeah.
And that's nice.
Oh, good. Well, that's nice. I think there was a compliment there somewhere.
There was. There was an absolute compliment.
That's very nice.
I just wish that we could be friends.
Yeah,
we're nice. I've always liked you.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is being a comedian, which is... I think I might mention this in another podcast, but with Sean Hughes, who sadly died last week, and I've just been at his funeral. He wasn't someone I saw a lot, but I was talking about this to Ed Byrne when he was doing the podcast, I think backstage. Mm-hmm. But as comedians, you don't see each other for 5 or 6 or 7 years,
yeah.
And then you just see each other and you're just back into the... It's, I think, the kinship of the job.
Yeah.
And the fact that you know, that's just the way it is, isn't it? You're on a bill with each other,
so.
And then you'd see each other and you're sort of back to where
And
you
then there's people that you grow up in the industry with,
yeah.
Who then you don't see as often because either you get busy or, you know, they get busy, you both get busy, and you know, then you're with like families and stuff, and so you don't. I mean, a friend who I grew up with in the industry was Bill Bailey. Bill and I started around the same time when he was in a double act called the Rubber Bishops, who were superb. And so we kind of knew each other well, and he's the same kind of person. If I don't see him for 2 years, or we chat on the phone occasionally, but like, well, Bill, well, John, how are you?
Yeah.
And it was like it was yesterday, and of course, there is a kind of kinship in this business, and they have a comedian's Christmas party every year in the first week of January that the lovely Susan Murray puts together. So it's where the comics can download after being attacked verbally and physically over the Christmas period by the British people who are so good at Christmas. you know, it really is the time of goodwill. So the comics, and the thing that she always puts out in the advert for the night is no civilians.
Right.
And I know that sounds like a rather sort of odd word to use, but I get exactly what she means.
Yeah.
That, you know, that sometimes it's just, you just need people who are as mad as you in the same room,
yeah.
You know.
Well, it's good, but people come from lots of different backgrounds as comedians.
They certainly do.
And it's whatever people say and whatever say, oh, you've got an advantage because you go here or you come from there. But actually, you've got to be able to make people laugh. And that's it. So you've got to be good at what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, when I started out, I was very angry about everything, of course. My first act, I was called the Angry Young Accordionist. I know. And I used to go on stage and rant and rave about the politics in Ireland and Red Wedge and all this kind of stuff. And I used to play the accordion in between ranting at people. And one of my opening phrases was, the definition of a gentleman is somebody who can play the accordion but chooses not to. which then I would follow up with, because Oscar Wilde, in fact, actually said that.
Right. You
know? Yeah, he was hilarious. but then again, he also said one night, not tonight, Lord Bosey, I've got an arse like the flag of Japan. But they never talk about... they never... that quote isn't quite as famous. Was that a bit rude?
That's as rude as you like on this, don't worry. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about, before we get on to the Harald Schmidt Show, which you're best known for.
Yes.
but the Red Wedge, so you started off as a musician, is that right?
Yeah, I'm from an Irish family, and so my
John
parents...
John Maloney?
I know, who'd have thought? Yeah. I know, well spotted, Morse. So I played the accordion from a very young age, 8 or 9, 10. I started at that age and used to play in all the Irish pubs and stuff.
Yeah.
And then my girlfriend at the time got back from, she was the president of the students' union in about 1983-84, and she came in one evening and said, oh, they're putting this thing called Red Wedge together, which was kind of artists for labour, essentially. She said, oh, they're looking for a secretary, somebody who can sort of like take all the minutes and stuff. And because I was a student, I was doing nothing. So, I was studying German. I eventually became a German teacher. Well, I wasn't German when I was a teacher. I was teaching the language rather than just taking over other classrooms for no apparent reason. I was teaching rather than, you know, their kind of genetic urge. It was just a thing. It was a language thing, is what I'm trying to say. My granddad actually shot down two German planes. Unfortunately, he did it in 1971. But he said you could never be too careful. And the way things are going, he's probably right. So Red Wedge. Yeah, so they needed a secretary for Red Wedge. And Paul Weller used to turn up because he'd left the jam and gone into the style council. So the first few meetings, I was just sitting there it's like kind of the rush of no blood from the head. I was, you know, just almost like in fainting mode, seeing one of my heroes used to go to most of the meetings, and then eventually slagged off Red Wedge. He said it was too political. The clue was in the title, mate. But it was just I was being pushed around by politicians. No, you weren't. You were hopefully selling the Labour idea to youngsters. And like Billy Bragg was there, and people like Lenny Henry would come along, and it was just amazing. As a 20-year-old boy, to be sitting with these kind of cultural musical comedy icons, and you'd go, oh, you want to go for a pint after? You'd be sitting in a pub in like Stockwell with, you know, Jerry Dammers and Paul Weller, and it was just amazing. And then we, Addison Cresswell, God rest him, organised the Red Wedge comedy tour, and I had the balls to phone him up one afternoon and said, do you know what you need during the interval? You need somebody to play the accordion. And Addison, who was a very famous agent, he passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. So you've got some balls, mate, to fucking just call me up and say that, you know. The students' mass disappeared into the student union bar to buy a pint of bitter for 7p. I sat in the interval playing the accordion and eventually got moved to second on the bill after Craig Charles doing some poetry, because you should always follow poetry with an Irish London accordionist. It's been the classic theatre move ever since. I believe it heavily influenced people like Bogdanovich these days. He generally puts an accordion player in... No, he doesn't. That's just nonsense. So that was Red Wedge, yeah. And I loved every minute of it. Loved every minute. You know, you see these stars and stuff.
Yeah. How successful was the Red Wedge tour in getting the Labour?
We lost. lost in 19. Because the election was 1985, wasn't it? Yeah, and then they hung on with all us until 1991, wasn't it? And then us lot came in 1997, I think. Well, yeah. I can't remember exactly. No, 1987 was the election. That's it. June the 11th, 1987. That's right. Suddenly it all kicked in. Suddenly the OCD kicked in. So yes. Yeah, we lost, but don't blame me. I did my best.
It's all down to the accordion. Yeah, everyone was saying, I'm going to vote Labour. Oh, not the accordion.
Oh, no, God, there's a bloke playing a Palo Soprani dual couple of BC accordion. Oh, no, it's just, I hate chromatic accordions.
So basically you just started doing jokes around that, and then the accordion kind of got...
Yeah, the accordion thankfully, got squeezed out.
Hey! Oh, you've got...
Got squeezed out.
If you only thought of that joke at the time, you'd still be using it.
I'd still be doing the interval.
Because Jim Tavares stuck with his...
The double bass.
Yeah, double bass.
But he was funny. I was shit. I was genuinely... I mean, maybe some critics consider that still to be the case, but I would just like rant about something. I remember doing gags about if the Republic of Era, or Era as it's called, Ireland, had been called Nicaraguera, you know, people might have had a bit more of a consciousness about it like that. So it was just rubbish. And at the end, I'd sort of go, Thatcher's rubbish, hooray! And then I'd get booked again. So it was that, it really genuinely was that simple in those days. You know, tawdry gags, hate Thatcher, done. Repeat gig.
And so after that, did you leave the comedy behind for it and go into teaching, or were you still doing the comedy during the teaching?
My father, God rest him, said to me, get a trade before you do any of this comedy nonsense. So while I was doing open spots and stuff, which is unpaid gigs where you go up and you try and do a bit and then hopefully you get paid by the club, he was sensible enough as he was, said, no, get yourself a proper job just in case it doesn't work out. And, 28 years full-time now, so it has kind of worked out. But I understand that he was right. I guess I did it in order that he didn't have sleepless nights rather than me.
Well, I think, again, it's a similar... When I wanted to do comedy, you know, it was the same thing for our parents' generation.
Yeah.
It was just an absolute no-go. There was no reason why anyone who hadn't worked in show business and had no...
See, that's exactly right. And I think the thing that he... The only time I think that he thought that I'd kind of made it, as it were, is when I would phone from exotic places. You know, like I'd phone up from like Hong Kong or something, or Sydney Comedy Festival or Melbourne. I'd phone up, oh, Dad, I'm in Melbourne. You know, like, Eileen, quick, get to the Ford. He's in Melbourne. Just, he's in Hong Kong. You know, so the fact that I was allowed to get on planes to do what I do meant that it had a certain validity for him and for them, I suppose.
Yeah, but I just remember when I was, you know, when you're in your 20s and getting flown out to Canada or Australia or wherever, it was just, you couldn't believe that this was happening.
I was just in Bahrain last week for a couple of nights doing some gigs, and it still amazes me. I still genuinely, firstly, love the job, but secondly, realise how bloody lucky I am that for something that you actually enjoy doing, that people will firstly give you money for it, and secondly, show you a bit of the world at the same time.
It's just
amazing. It's crazy. It's crazy.
So I think you're a very interesting comedian for lots of reasons.
Oh, yes.
And it's quite hard to kind of get this I'm
a bit worried about this next bit.
Well, it's because you have been working on the club circuit for, as you say, 28 years.
Yeah. I went full-time when I was about 25, about 28 years.
But you've still... and a lot of the club comedians go, I'm not going to do Edinburgh shows. Mm. You can't get onto the radio, can't get onto the TV. There's a lot of sort of bitterness, and I think a lot of it is justified amongst the excellent... Well, I think what's interesting... You're doing lots of interesting things. I just think there's so much I'm trying to get into this into this sentence. It's a bit hard to express. But, a comedian like you, who's been working for 28 years, the TV companies aren't, like, banging down your door going,
we want you
to come present something.
No.
But yet, there's no other job you would do
where
someone who'd been working for 28 years would be looked over and someone who'd just come in, like, in the last 6 months and done...
Yeah, this is true. There are... They're now training embryos to do comedy now. It's kind of like IVF comedy is now happening. But that's okay. There's a great quote by a comic called Liam Malone who said, and I don't 100% agree with this, but I get the sentiment. He says comedy is a little bit like sex, that people will pay money to watch young people doing it badly than older people doing it well. And I sort of agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, when I go to festivals around the world, as we are lucky enough to do, the older comic, male or female, are celebrated by the fact that they're still bloody well doing it. Do you know what I mean? There's a guy called Irwin Barker, who's a Canadian comic, who passed away a couple of years ago. He's in his 70s. But he was just as much celebrated as being on the international festival circuit and on all the international TV galas as some 24-year-old, you know, just out of uni, scrabbling to teach German.
Yeah.
You know, like and I like that, and I think that's something that we're going to have to find here, because I think the older comics here, older, people envisage that they're the kind of Dickie Bow mainstream comics, whereas in fact, we're all getting older now.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and even people like Les Dawson, I mean, he was 43 before he was first on television. I mean, 43 years old.
Yeah.
And, I mean, his stuff, one of my favourite jokes is... He says to his missus, he says, and of course this is he says to her, do you believe in reincarnation? And she says, you are. And he says, do you believe in reincarnation? She says, what's that? He says, you could come back as a different animal. So she says, what, I could come back as a cow? He says, you're not listening. Now the thing with that, if you want to be offended by that, great, there are children starving in this world, so get some fucking perspective. But the thing is... But that's just, that's got everything in a joke. Okay, it's sexist. But what it is the perfect, because it's got the repetition of the Jeopardy, and it's all there in one thing.
Well, and it's about him, regardless of whether it's, it's about his feelings about his wife,
Which weren't real.
And it's a little play within the thing, so it's a pretend thing. But it's, that's it. You've been trying to get together, and I think you're doing quite well with this, aren't you? You're trying to get sort of a basically live at the Apollo for comedians over 50.
Yeah, I saw the listings two series ago for the Live at the Apollo, and excellent, please don't get me wrong, excellent comics. But I just thought that they were all just rather on the young side. So yeah. When I was sitting there one night sniffing an arrogant Sauvignon Blanc, it was. It had, honestly, the bouquet was just irresistible. As was the second bottle. I wrote down Dead at the Apollo. I thought that was quite a nice idea for old buggers like me. So, and then I sort of put it out in the ether on Facebook last year. It was on October the 28th, oddly enough, that okay. I put it out on Facebook. And I remember that because the day before would have been my dad's birthday, and I'd lost him a couple of years back, and I was feeling shit. And I thought, no, turn this bad feeling into something positive. And then, so I just wrote that down and then put it out there. And loads of comics came back to me, said, well, this is just a great idea. Try and make it happen. So we're going into production in January. We've hired a theatre. All the comics have to be over 50. All the crew have to be over 50. And the other proviso I've sort of said to the other comics is not to mention our age, because I don't want 24 comics going, oh, God, me back, oh, you know. So it's just going to be... Because essentially there are... probably 30 or 40 headliners, people who have been headlining massive clubs for a quarter of a century, who I think just deserve the break. We've all had our break in terms of that we're actually working and living and doing what we enjoy doing. But there are, you know, people like sort of Pierre Hollins or Paul Thorne or Mary Burke or Nina Benjamin, people like that, who are just fantastic. And I just think they need an airing. And so we're actually funding it ourselves as well. Every comic, as I've said, we've got to put £1,000 in each in order to get the production budget together. So what we want to do is take it to, rather than sort of make a pilot and go, oh, can we have some more? We're actually going to make 8 of them. Yeah. And then just take it to the television companies and say, well, here's the finished product. Here are 24 headliners. And if you don't want it on your channel, why not? Because that would kind of worry me, really. They're not funny. Oh, well, these people have been doing it for a quarter of a century. Yeah. Who can walk into a very indifferent room where they're not well known, and essentially, so in football terms, they're 1-0 down, yeah. And within 20 minutes they're winning 5-1, yeah. And then they go on to another gig and do the same, and then go to another gig that night and do the same. These are incredible people.
There are some, and I know exactly the kind of acts you're talking about. I did a benefit gig at the. Banan Banana. I can't remember if you were on, but it was like I think you might have been. It might have been your benefit gig, but it was. But there was. I'm very old. I can't remember. But there was just there was 4 or 5 guys, and they all came on and they absolutely killed it. And yeah, I don't do 20-minute slots in clubs very much.
No.
And it was. And I really struggled to do it because it's a really difficult.
Yeah.
After they've done so well and it's made it so effortless.
I mean, the hour shows, which I know you've done for many years, you are so incredibly prolific and just. I mean. Fantastic at what you do, but an hour show is very different to a 20 minutes. I mean, you've got a loyal. When you go to Edinburgh now, people know who you are,
exactly, yeah.
And they know they're going to get a great hour because you know you've got an incredible comedy brain. You're an incredibly funny man, and they know that they're going to get that. But when it's somebody who, as I say, is 1-0 down,
yeah.
That there's as much art in that as there is for somebody doing an hour, which might be say like a conceptual hour about something. But you know, I've seen. Comics just turn a room round which looks impossible, and just that the art of being able to do that, and it is an art. Okay, it's not saving lives. We're not brain surgeons, but you know what I mean. There's something still pretty damn impressive about it.
You get so many. Even doing this podcast, I get emails from people who are saying, I was very depressed, or I was going through something really terrible, and this helped me through. And comedy does have that function, So that's I know there's a sort of with comedians there's bitterness and there's. There's backbiting and saying, why they're doing well and I'm not doing well. I think there's a lot of camaraderie as well behind that.
There's more positivity than there is negativity.
There is. But you can understand there's only a certain number of spaces, I suppose, if you want to make that move up. And I think to a great degree, the longer I've gone on my career, I've thought, exactly the same as you're saying, hey, the fact I'm doing this, I'm doing this on my own terms, this is the success. It doesn't need to go any further than that.
No, it doesn't.
You can understand those guys.
Yes, of course.
Who've just done every Saturday for 25 years and stormed it and going, why is this kid on TV and I'm not on TV?
Well, you see, I think that's a very good point, and that's something that I thought of as well, because one of the people who I was fed up of listening to moaning about it was me. So I just thought, well, you know, this can be done. You know, with respect to anybody who works in the entertainment industry on the other side of the camera, it's not rocket science. You know, you hire an experienced production crew, you put them in a good theatre,
yeah.
and hopefully, because of their experience, just say, well, press record and let's see how we do.
But that's, you know, I think that's a good realisation that I had in doing this. You know, you can just get on and...
Just do it.
Do it yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a great idea that everyone puts some money in to do it and then they've invested
also,
in it.
But also, I'll tell you a little secret here. There are some comics who are fantastic, but do you know what? They haven't got £1,000. They don't have a spare £1,000. And there are other comics who are subbing them.
Yeah.
You know, I can think of three comics who I won't name, so it wouldn't be fair to them, who... have said, I'd love to do this, but I can't find a spare grand. Yeah. But I know three other comics who do have a spare grand and said, well, I'll pay for them.
That's brilliant.
And that's pretty damn cool, isn't it? You know, and that shows the spirit behind it. And then there's another very famous comic who I sent an email to and said, you know, we're a little bit short on production budget. And he has pledged £5,000 towards the production fee.
Right.
And that's somebody who, you know, is filling stadiums and just went, actually, yeah, go on.
Yeah.
And so that shows the spirit behind it.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a shame that it has to be like that. It should just be that, you know, these men and women are funny. The fact that they are of a certain age should be irrelevant. But unfortunately, it's not.
Yeah, but, you know, I think in lots of ways people are breaking through the barriers that there are closed shops in all these things and it's difficult to get through. You know, it's like we were talking about backstage, you know, I find it very difficult to get into any of those panel shows, you know, and I think I know I'd be good on some of those panel shows that I can never get on, and it's, you know, and that's all that you've got on TV now. So it's to just do it yourself. But what I like about you, as well as, you know, as well as having worked very hard as stand-up and done those clubs, you have said, I'm going to do Edinburgh, and you do Edinburgh every now and again. You do like
every
an
three
hour
or four years, I go up and do an hour, and it's more sit-down comedy, really, because it is. I just sort of like, I have a high stool, just put on a shirt and tie and talk. For an hour, there's no massive presentation. It's just literally not even a follow spot, just a spot, and so I cut down to that. And I try and kind of make the words do the work rather than jumping up and down. You know, I remember once in Edinburgh, it's not 2010. I moved on stage about 3 foot. And I was knackered. I had to take the next night off. It wasn't easy.
And that's led to you getting your Radio 4 show that you've done two series of?
I've done a couple of series called, imaginatively, called The John Maloney Show. It's me. And then, who was he? It's just a fat bloke with a lesbian haircut. Who is he? Fucking old Katie Lang's let herself go, hasn't she? Constant craving, I don't think so. Constant fucking chocolate. So why did I pretend? That was very Brechtian, wasn't it? Did I break down or did I build the fourth wall just then?
I'm not sure what you did. You made a fifth wall, I think.
It was die Verfremdung's effect. Yeah, I'm feeling a bit alienated. Yeah, grammar school, do you know what I mean?
But was it the first series or the second series that a clip got on Pick of the Year on Radio 4?
Yeah,
that is a pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was episode. It was episode one of series one. I was doing a piece about my cat, Edward, who was diagnosed as being stressed. I took him to the vet, and then the vet said he's stressed, and the issue being he sleeps for 23 hours a day. So for that one waking hour window, he can't cope. So that was the essence of this sketch that was Pick of the Year. About the fact of having to take him to have his temperature taken, which he didn't enjoy. In fact, he made a noise that I'd never, you know, that's the noise he made as the thermometer entered his anus. And this is the kind of thing that Radio 4 were craving, which is why it was Pick of the Year. So, yeah. And then the second series was just done all right. That was Podcast of the Week or something. And then I just found out relatively recently that they've commissioned a third series. So, you know, let's see.
It's brilliant, though.
I'm happy, you know. I mean, it's obviously... Well, I never thought that... It's a difficult thing that certain things you think aren't your natural constituency or your natural home.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, I realised that most of the prejudice is mine rather than other people's.
Yeah.
I think they used to call it chip on the shoulder, but that's the thing they always use to keep the working classes down. the ruling classes have always done that, inbred syphilitic bastards. But the thing is, I just turned off the ironometer. I didn't think that that would be my thing, and it is, and I'm delighted. Because Radio 4 is one of those, it's this iconic cultural, and they say to you, you know, will you do something for us? And you, wow, yeah, you know, I still have that thing of wanting to pinch myself about it, because, you know, I just didn't think it was for me. I can't put it any less well than that.
And do you think, is there any chance of that going on and getting taken up by TV as well?
Well, I don't know. I hope so, because they're kind of series of sort of sitcom-y, sketchy monologue type stuff. It's all bits of everything going on. Like one of the episodes, last one, was me just doing, being at the other end of the phone trying to get my utility company changed. And we all know the nightmare that is, you know, all the security names and numbers and all this, and, you know, the first school you went to and all that. So they're all sort of self-contained units. Yeah. There's no particular continuum. But the two most popular episodes have involved my cat, of course. You know, you try and write this kind of coruscating, visceral satire about the state of the nation, and the funniest episode is the cat having a thermometer put in his bum, which generally is quite funny, really, because he did make that noise, and he looked quite disappointed when I didn't buy him dinner. Or the vet. So, yeah. It's lovely to have a thing on Radio 4. It is, you know.
No,
I hope.
But I just think, because, you know, I think it is, a lot of it is about a lot of these things in life, you know, not just in comedy. People think, oh, that's, you know, there's no point in me applying for that job or that university or that, you know. Yeah. If you get up and give it a go, you might be proven right. You might not get there.
But I mean, you're from an ordinary background, aren't you? Pretty ordinary
guy.
My
parents are teachers. So
And Stuart was a pretty ordinary background as well. And the two of you achieved massively. You got to, you know, one of the best universities in the world. And I mean, did your career start? Were you doing like footlights? I can't remember.
It's the Oxford Review. Oh, I don't like to talk about going to Oxford. We did the Oxford Review. I loved comedy as a teenager. That was my whole thing. I didn't like music, I liked comedy.
Do you think that did help you more than if you hadn't?
I'm not sure.
Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure, because yes, in a lot of ways. Because we met some people and we had 3 years of doing comedy instead. I should have been studying.
Tell
comedy.
Me that, I know.
So you had that safe environment, but that could have been anywhere. And that could have been another university,
yeah,
to be fair.
Yeah, true, because, I mean, Manchester Uni had a hiatus, didn't it?
Ben Elton and
all that lot,
all that
from
lot
the young ones in that era.
Yeah. So it's just finding people that you work with. And Armando and Ben Moore and Al Murray and Kevin Cecil and Alan.
He's a genius. Al Murray is... I do this thing every year called the Balham Comedy Festival, which Richard very kindly has done over the years. But Al Murray's set 2 years ago, that hour... I mean, he's untouchable.
Yeah.
He is unbelievable. His energy, the writing, you know, you just watch it and go, I'll just go back into teaching, you know. And all the other comics go, yeah, you're right. Not just me. Yeah, you should go back into teaching. Maybe I should. But every other comic's like, why do we bother doing this? You know. And I think another comic who's very much like that is Mark Steele as well.
Yeah.
Mark Steele is incredible. I mean, just the use of language and just the passion of it all, the way that he can take an idea and just run it to its most ridiculous extent. I mean, Al Murray said one night that he minimalises everything. Like, what's the most ridiculous position that you could get to in a joke? And then you move backwards from that to build it to there.
Yeah.
And I thought that was such a lovely idea, because he had that great joke about the Channel Tunnel train, that it takes from Waterloo to Dover, takes about like 4 hours. But once it gets from, you know, Calais to Paris, it only takes like an hour. You know, the fact that it's more efficient, but it is in fact because the driver is English and he just wants to get out of France as quickly as possible. It's such a lovely, and what a great, see, he will have started with that as an idea and then come back from it. Yeah. And that's why I just adore Al Murray. I think the pub landlord is just genius.
But what was nice about the Balham Confest, which I wanted to go on to as well, but you draw comedians from a lot. When I did it last, Paul Daniels, or maybe it was time for Paul Daniels.
Paul Daniels did it 2 years in a row, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm friends with quite a lot of mainstream comics. Yeah. Jim Davidson is a friend of mine, which generally makes people go, boo, like that, because it's such a lovely, natural, knee-jerk reaction. You know,
well, you're very different. You're very different politically.
I'm a fierce.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's Corbynite, and he's, yeah, so... but see, that's one of the reasons that we get on, is that we are so politically different.
Yeah.
But, of course, there have been stories about Jim in the papers over the years. But there were stories that don't come out about Jim. For example, there was an Asian woman. She was a police officer. She was killed outside in Luton a few years ago. Okay. And her husband had a nervous breakdown because, as one would, not surprisingly, of course, and he was going to lose his home and that. And then so Jim put on a benefit at the Luton Empire, whatever it was, and paid off the guy's mortgage. Now, that's not good news for the papers. Papers don't want to say that Jim Davidson, you know, has raised money for an Asian family. They don't. That doesn't suit their narrative.
Yeah.
And yet he did. Now, we could go, oh, well, he did that once. But you know what? Sometimes just give the guy a break. He's there are people of various political hues who aren't particularly nice, but... I'll defend him. I think he's, you know, underneath that complicated, difficult man, there's a heart of gold, and there is, and I've seen it. Yeah. You know, and then sometimes he can be impossible. But that's just his nature. You know, we go out for a Chinese meal after like doing a show with him or something. I remember he did this one night. He just sat there. And I could just see the cloud, and he just went, I've just got to go. And he just got up like and no big flouncy showbiz thing. He just went. Oh, no. And so he can be a troubled soul, but he's a nice man in there. There is. I'm sorry it doesn't suit everybody's opinion of him, but I can only give you mine.
I like that about you because I think a lot, you know, as you say, I mean, you're kind of not exactly a contradiction, but because you're kind of conservative with a small C, I think. You're very much a family man, and you're Catholic, and you're very religious. But you are very, you know, you're very, on Twitter, you're always having a nip at the, you know, the more right-wing Labour MPs. And,
in
a friendly way, I think.
But it's not that friendly. I want them deselected. Fucking quizzlings. I do. Wes Streeting and I, he's the MP for the area that I grew up in.
Yeah.
Grew up in. He and I have an occasional tete-a-tete on Twitter. 144 characters of bile from me. It's just my opinion is just spend more time attacking the real enemy. You know, attack the Tories. If you spend as much time attacking them as you do Corbyn, well, you know, we might have got a few more seats. I think the Corbyn is the best thing that's happened in British politics in my lifetime, and I've been involved actively in politics since I was 18 because it's just exciting at last. We've got somebody who actually says what he fucking means, and it's just beautiful. Thank you. One person back. And the rest rustle their guardians in disgust.
It's a very divisive figure, and I did have a problem with him, but my problem really was I thought he wouldn't get elected.
That's right, and that was everybody's problem initially.
I still voted for him, but I didn't think he'd get elected. So that is exciting.
Yeah, but what he did as well, which was fantastic, in his first PMQs, and don't forget, he was very awkward about this because he was the backbencher who had a conscience while the rest of the Labour Party MPs would file out as he was saying what he thought about a political situation. So, of course, he was a bit crap for the first few PMQs. But what he did, which was very interesting, is that he would bring up a letter from a member of the public and say, well, yeah. you know, Julie from Chalton. And at first, it was like, woo! And then, actually, that's now become part of the political currency. Actually, yeah, here is a member of the public who has written to me, because these letters have to be real, otherwise he would have been hung, drawn and quartered by now. Yeah. And that's... And so when the, you know, the conservative syphilitics would jeer him... he's reading a letter out from the great unwashed. I bet it smells of cabbage. And they'll never understand our literary allusions. That it suddenly became part of the... It's now part of the mainstream for a member of the public's letter to be read out. And I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think momentum is brilliant as well. Yeah. The fact that momentum is going into these various seats to get rid of these bastards. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, I think we're going to Uxbridge next Saturday to get rid of... you know his name, Cunty the Pretend Clown. Boris Johnson, that's the fellow. Ooh, bejabers, something in Latin, ad infinitum. Ha! So, yeah, so I think there's been some great movements.
And I think, you know, what's interesting...
I feel like I need to get my accordion out again.
It's good.
I'm getting angry again.
No, it's interesting.
It's challenging.
Well, what's interesting about it, but it's also interesting that Corbyn didn't toe the line in the other way, you know, so you can say all that very much, but yes. When he was a backbencher, he was doing exactly what the other people, what you're accusing the other...
But there was only one of him, see? That's absolutely right. Yeah. He voted against most of the Labour Party's policies.
You have to stay with what, you know, he stayed with what he believed, and so those other politicians are as well. But I agree that if you're a Labour supporter, the Conservatives...
But they're scared shitless of him. They were laughing at him 2 years ago, the establishment, everybody, and now they're scared shitless, because what he did was he brought out the youth vote, as we know, and that's been the holy grail of politics since the Attlee government, is to get people between 18 and 25 to vote, and that's what he actually managed to do. And of course the sneering press called it cultism. Of course it can't just be people, young people, for once going, oh, actually I will voice my dissent or voice my agreement with this. They're all brainwashed, you know. But did you see the Tories? They tried to do a Tory Glastonbury. They did in some field outside Harpenden or something. About, you know, seven of them turned up with a couple of Jack Russells or something. You know what I mean? And so it didn't quite work.
Yeah, you know? Well, I think, you know, but I think certainly whoever it is, the anyone under 40 in this, the young people who were saying we don't want all our TVs need to get together and. You know, fight against it, because they're just getting shafted by older people than us. It's the cunts over 60 who should be worried.
Yeah. Yeah. And that'll be us quite soon.
It will.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And you're a religious man. I think you're a contradictory.
Yes. I'm a yes no person.
Yeah.
I'm a Catholic, yeah. I don't agree with everything within the Catholic doctrine, but, you know, then again, I know people who are humanists who send their kids to faith schools. So you know, we can all have a contradiction. I think Marcus Brigstock always has a go at me about this, but I always say to him, this is just too beautiful just to be science. It's just too beautiful. And it's a lovely phrase from people of a certain age will remember a song called Ichigo Park by the Small Faces, where Steve Merritt sings, "It's all too beautiful." Yeah. And that phrase stuck with me since I first heard that song when I was 12, 13, 14. And it is just too beautiful. I mean, your son was born a couple of weeks ago, and that is, again, for the second time for you, I believe, probably one of the most too beautiful things that you will ever see. And I just think it's just greater than science. I think Ghosts by the Jam, track 2 from their final album, is better than science. It's too beautiful to just be music. Music is too beautiful. You know, the Mona Lisa is too beautiful just to be somebody going, oh, well, you know, well, what he could see there was mood and perspective. No, what he could see there was God. So that's how I see it. And maybe I'm old-fashioned, but there we are. But I managed to out-Catholic Frank Skinner one night, though. Because I beat him on the Catholic stakes. Because a mate of mine is a priest, Father Frank, and I've known Frankie for years. And we went to see a variety show because Father Frank's dad is actually Jimmy Cricket, the old comic. Great. So me and Frank went to see Jimmy at the Croydon Fairfield Halls. And Frank Skinner was walking in, and my Frank, Priest Frank, was facing the other way from him. And when Frank said, "Oh, hello, John. Hello, Frank. How are you?" And my Priest Frank turned around, I went, "Yeah, 1-0 to me." So Frank now brings the Pope with him to gigs. He's very competitive like that, you know. He goes to Mass every day, I think he said. I don't think I could handle that.
No.
I think also, but sort of once a week or even once a fortnight, I'll be honest with you. Sometimes just to have that relative peace for 30 minutes is nice.
Yeah.
Just to sit there with the people you love the most, and then you could do that in a restaurant. Yeah, you could. But I do it in a church. Yeah. Sorry.
If you do it in a restaurant, you're not actually in Jesus' body and stuff.
No, there's no... what's it called? There's no transubstantiation. Yeah. You know. Although the red wine is generally better in restaurants. No, I don't bang on about my religion, really, but I just think, yeah, it's too beautiful for science. That's the only way I can put it.
Fuck science, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck.
It's only numbers, isn't it?
It's only numbers, exactly.
And look, the people at my school who were good at science, right, used to write their names in runic symbols. The fuck is that about? You write your name on your exercise book in a runic symbol. That's dinner money stuff, that, isn't it? That's when you take the dinner money off them. It's rubbish, isn't it? It's just maths, isn't it?
It is. Tell us about D. Harold Schmidt show. That's what I want to know about.
Oh, so
you,
right.
Because you were one of the first comedians to do your act in a different language, weren't you?
Yeah, I went over to Germany to do a chat show called the Harold Schmidt Show. And it was basically Harold Smith, essentially.
Yeah.
He was a brickie from Leytonstone. No, he wasn't. And his whole backdrop was the same as Letterman. You know, he had the kind of like Berlin backdrop and all this, and he'd read out the sort of top 10 jokes from the week and throw them over his shoulder and all that. So, yeah, I got invited to do... I used to do a routine about trying not to fart during sex, as you do. Try not to, in fact. And, you know, the idea of like trying to keep the fart in and all that. And if we like the English humour when you all talk about farting the whole time. You will laugh your bottoms. I did that routine in German. And I remember watching it in a pub that night because it was pre-recorded at about 5 o'clock. And I'm in this pub in Cologne. And there was just this bloke sitting around the table. You could just see their face go... This is shit. and half and scheiße. I'm like, they're not really enjoying this. What was interesting was to go to another country and try something in a different language. So yeah, it was great. It was great for that reason.
Yeah,
you know.
And so, have you done more than that? Is that the only?
I used to do it in Berlin and Hamburg. There's a couple of comedy clubs. I used to go over there and do it. But you know, not really. I try and stick to English. I find it easier. So do the Germans.
Yeah. It's very admirable when you see these going.
Yeah, I mean,
guys
Eddie Izzard has really embraced that, but he's embraced it as that kind of like political internationalism, you know, which I think is great. I think. You know, I've got a lot of time for him. He's a lovely bloke, as you know. And again, like Al, he's just another one of these geniuses that you're lucky to have met on your path. You know, I mean, there's a few people who I genuinely feel I'm in the presence of genius when I watch them. Yeah. Al Murray is one of them. Eddie Izzard is another one. Bill Bailey is another one. Yeah. You know, I'll just say it because they're massive stadium, you know, iconic comics, which they are. But then there's people who you wouldn't have heard of, you just think, this is just fantastic.
Yeah.
There's a double act called the Raymond and Timkins Review, for example, who their act is genuinely pathetic. and that's what they say. That's their opening line. And if you just have a look at them online, or please go and see them live, and them, just the sense of joy that they can bring to an audience with the most stupid act I think I've ever seen is wondrous. That's the great thing about this. That's the, you know, that you've got these amazing intellectual comics, and then you've got these guys who are slapstick, but they're all it's all still part of the same game and part of the same discipline, you know.
Yeah.
It's great to watch.
Well, without that variety, you know, there needs to be more variety. And probably when you started doing stand-up in the London circuit, there was a lot more literal variety.
Yeah, there was. I mean, Jonglers in Battersea, for example, they had a room above a pub. And it'd take about 300 people, but it was an extensive room, and they would have trapeze in there. They'd actually put in those kind of like hanging things. So people, they'd have a trapeze act followed by a singer, followed by a stand-up comic. But then it all became a bit more homogenised when the stand-up show, for example, started on the BBC. I was lucky enough to be on one of the first episodes of that in about 1988 or so, something like that. I can't remember now. And that was very much just the genre of just standing there with a microphone and telling jokes, and then that got reflected in the clubs as well, which is why I wasn't then doing as much music as I used to do. But firstly, because I probably wrote some more jokes for once, and I wish I could write a few more. And so that's you could see that happening. You could see the standardisation of it. But regardless, brilliant people still came out of that.
Sure.
Like the Rubber Bishops, who was Bill's first double act, and then he went solo. And you know, people like Sean Locke came out as well. Just great, great comics.
And do you think? I mean, because it's gone so big on TV and the stadiums, and a lot of the club comics are struggling. And Jonglers, you just mentioned, just closed down again for the third or fourth time. But it looks like it might be gone for good now. Maybe.
I think so. It's a shame because when Jonglers was running well, it was running well. But then they were bringing in inexperienced show managers and comics who weren't quite good enough to be headlining. So I think some of the quality went down slightly. But I think the difficult thing is now is to convince people to go to these smaller clubs.
Yeah.
A lot of people, their experience of wanting to go to a live gig is to go to a stadium or to go to the O2 to go and see Mickey Flanagan or someone like that.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not knocking him. He's a great comic. But I so wish that people would still go to the 100-seaters and to the 150-seaters and see people who they just don't know. I mean, I do a charity night every year at the Comedy Store for an orphanage that I help to fund. And generally, the people that the public don't know are the ones who kind of go down best because they're a surprise to them that they're as good as they are.
Yeah.
And also, they're the street fighters. You know, there are comics who are out there three or four nights a week who are just, you know, they're not at all ring rusty. They're just there and they can just go bang for 10 to 12 minutes.
Sure.
You know, and as I say, that's why I'm trying to give them a chance on that TV show.
Yeah, it's great. And a club like the Ballon Banana that you're very much associated with is still, I mean, I was playing that in 1989, that club, and I think it's still as good.
Well, it is. Every comic who is a comic has come through Banana Cabaret or the store. But actually, Banana more because the store is its own entity. It's an amazing venue just up the road from here, as I'm sure people know it. It's just on the other side of Leicester Square. But Banana Cabaret, it's still kind of very. It still feels grassroots sometimes. And when people like your good self and Al and people come back to do it. When I get out my little black book and phone people like Richard to come and do a preview, there's never any dissension from any comics because they know that Dave, who runs the club, that his heart and soul is in it.
Yeah.
So they know the room. They know Dave means it. They know that I'm going to give them a good intro and an outro and make sure that they're happy and need whatever they need in the dressing room because I help to produce the Ballon Festival every year. And so people are very loyal to the club because Dave was there when very rich people now needed the money.
Yeah, but it's true. It's quite a rare. There are a few clubs. Mm. Downstairs, the King's Head is always.
That's another one in Crouch End. Superb. Yeah.
They're kind of and the same people running it for three decades.
The same people.
Yeah,
it's amazing. And what's funny now is you're seeing comics. Children are now doing it, like Kevin Day's son has started stand-up comedy. Kevin Day is a great comic. Mark Steele's son, Elliot, has started to do it as well. So it's funny to see this new generation coming through whose mums and dads were doing the circuit years ago.
Yeah.
So it's a family affair.
Good. I'm going to ask you an emergency question.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Just to change the mood a little bit. It's nice, though, isn't it? It's been good, isn't it? Yeah, see? I don't know what I'm saying. She came on before. She was talking to me saying it won't be any good. She didn't. I've got to find a good one now for you. What do you... No, <wait. laughs> I've talked about that enough. Have you ever had a dream that accurately predicted the future?
I'm having it now.
I think I'm having it now.
Dreams are a very scary thing, aren't they?
Yeah.
I have that one, that anxiety one, which everybody seems to have, where I'm sitting in large rooms with no trousers on, or something like that.
Yeah.
No, surely that isn't just me. You know that kind of slightly those kind of vulnerable dreams.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I tell you the one when I have that disco nap, which a lot of comedians have at about 5 o'clock, where you have a little sleep between 5 and 6 before you go to your show in the evening. that can be the most traumatic dreams, because they think about, I can't find the stage, you know, and someone like Claire Muldoon from the Hackney Empire would go, where are you? Look, the stage is here. And I go down all these kind of different alleyways and corridors and things. And so I think that's just a subconscious thing about actually just being a shit comic.
I have loads about doing my A-levels, just constantly. About doing my A-levels when I'm 50 years old.
I've
got to go back to school and I'm going, why am I doing my A-levels again? I've got them.
Thank God, because mine is my degree.
Yeah.
Because I kind of like bluffed my way through my degree, because I took 2 years out in the middle as well. I was so desperate not to finish it because I actually just wanted to do entertainment. That you're right. I wake up and go, why am I doing my finals again? I've already got a bloody 2-2, and you know, they used to call it the drinker's degree, didn't they? I got a 2-2. I could find the bar, but not the example. I'm glad that we have similar anxiety. But no, I don't think I've ever predicted the future.
No. Have you ever fallen out of a hammock?
I've fallen out of a bed, but not a hammock. No, but I would find it actually physically, just dynamically impossible to get into a hammock. So the actual chance of falling out of it...
If I can get in a hammock... I love getting in a hammock.
Can you get in a hammock?
I can get in a hammock, but I have fallen out. Well, I tied up a hammock myself.
Right.
Then I turned out I don't know how to do knots, and so halfway through...
But is there a technique to getting it? I mean, do you have to sort of like go girth first?
I would
and then
go,
just hope that you've balanced everything?
I sort of sit in it and then swing.
Oh, right, so... So
you
ask
sit on
first.
The edge.
Oh, right, ask first, so you get in.
Swing round like that.
Oh, no, that's when I... That'd be me flopping out, so to speak. I'll be flopping out of my hammock at that point.
My wife gave me a hammock for one of my birthdays a few years ago, but then in the end we left it outside too long. It was on some poles, so you could have it anywhere.
No, hammocks are aerodynamically wrong for a man of my stature. Size. Weight.
All right, here's... Here's a religious question for you to answer.
Oh, no.
Thomas
Aquinas, that's always the answer.
I let it go with the science thing.
If you watch University Challenge, the answer is always Thomas Aquinas.
Why did Jesus say, why hast thou forsaken me on the cross? Had he forgotten about the plan that he and his dad had come up with to save mankind?
You know what? It is probably just science, isn't it?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, now, the thing is that when you say... I do like that. It's very good, you smarmy bastard. But the thing is... fucking creationist. No, you're an evolutionist, and it's great.
I believe in evolution.
All right, so do I, sort of.
Yeah, well, I mean, it
didn't all happen in 6 days. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
I think it took about 9.
At least...
At least. That's great. My God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Yeah.
It probably just hurt a bit, didn't it?
It did. When you'd be confused.
Yeah, and you know, if you're being crucified, it's going to smart, isn't it? Yeah. So that was the thing. He was just smarting, like bloody vinegar, and he's like, what did you do that for? You know, Dad, what's that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see that. There's that lovely joke I remember. It's at the Last Supper, and Jesus says to the gathered, he says, one of you tonight will betray me. Right? So Peter says, is it me, Lord? And Jesus goes, no. Paul says, is it me, Lord? And Jesus says, no. And Judas says, is it me, Lord? And Jesus says, is it me, Lord? It's just a great... I love the idea of a sarcastic Jesus, don't you? It's brilliant.
It is very good. There are two entries for John Maloney on IMDb, and I think they're both you.
Oh, okay.
Did you write for TV Burp for two...
Many years
two
ago,
episodes,
yeah, in the first few episodes of Harry Hill's TV Burp.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. Harry and I, again, started around the same time. He started a couple of years later than me. Harry was the first... There used to be a club called the Red Rose on the Seven Sisters Road in North London, and Harry was doing his first ever open spot. He was still a medic at St George's, and I was privileged enough to be on the bill that night and watched this guy, who this was only his like third gig or something, blow the bloody roof off.
Yeah.
And I sound like Michael Caine. I'm only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. Transubstantiation, you've got to be fucking joking. So, yeah, so Harry came on, and his opening line was, never go to a candlelit dinner with a moth. It was just a great line. It was just a great line. And he had six more minutes of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I remember saying to him after, God, man, you blew that away. You were just head and shoulders, mate. And he used to go down to a club in Brixton every Friday before he started to watch people. So, right. So he hadn't cheated, but when a lot of us started, there was no template. You would just get up there and try and do it. Whereas Harry at that point was able to go to an established club, the White Horse in Brixton, run by Roland and Claire Muldoon. And he said that he used to go there every Friday, he'd finish his shift and go down there and watch. But regardless, you know, he was still fantastic and still is. Yeah. You know.
It was a tie. I wrote for TV, but for about the first two episodes, so you must have come in after I decided to start. It was a very tough show to write for.
It wasn't easy, and I remember one of the producers was quite sort of like whiplashy. You know, if you can't come up with a joke, you've got to sit there until you do, and that's not quite how it. Well, I can't write like that.
No.
I find that quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes at 1:30 in the morning, I write something down and I look at it next day and go, oh yeah, that's got legs. Or I look at it and go, what the hell was that? You know, with some comics, like Mark Thomas, for example, was always very disciplined, where he would literally sit there with a blank piece of paper and just write until something happened.
Yeah.
And I wish I had that kind of discipline myself, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I think TV Burt, it was just because you had to watch so much.
Yeah.
Dan Mayer ended up working on it for a long time. He's a fantastic scriptwriter. He's done written for loads and loads.
Oh, yeah, they were the far.
But I think they were all, including Harry, starting to go slightly insane with that show.
Yeah,
because they said you're watching TV normally and all you're doing is looking in the background.
You're looking in the background.
To see what's going on, to see if you can spot the funny thing happening in the background.
But Harry was, as I say, from day one was fantastic. Matthew Hall. Harry Hall, he was originally, but then became Harry Hill because of some equity thing.
Right, yeah.
But he's brilliant. Yeah. Really nice bloke as well.
He is an excellent guy. You've got to get someone to collate your IMDb entries so they're on the same page.
All right, okay.
You're down as a writer, as a separate writer to John Malone. Right. Well, then I'm not sure that. Go and have a look at it.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure you wrote all of the things, but that was I knew you'd written for TV Burp, so I thought.
All right, well, what do you think I didn't write?
Let's have a look.
Oh, no, don't. Oh, no, don't.
I'll show you afterwards. We'll
have all right, okay.
You know, I just like to make sure the internet is correct.
Yeah.
Because it's a long job to get go through it, but
because it's only a little thing to correct, isn't it? The internet.
And you won the All Irish Fleida.
At
the age of 14, what is that?
Yes, Flakiol, which is the Irish for music competition. Kiol is music, and Fla is meeting or competition. And yeah, I was an accordion player. I won it for a few years. When I was young, and it didn't really hold any credibility.
Right.
Still doesn't.
No.
You know, to be playing air accordion in front of your mirror, you know, it's far more air guitar. It looks far sexier than standing there going. Just look like a fat butterfly, so, you know, it's never a good look.
No. My granddad had an accordion.
Yeah?
He was an Irish fan. Is it very much an Irish instrument, or is it just an? I think it's an instrument from.
Yeah, I think when it comes to music sessions, you need one louder instrument to keep everybody else in check. So I did a lot of music when I was a kid. I did enjoy it, although I didn't like being in pubs that young. Really, it was just a little bit scary sometimes. Yeah, you know? But which is why I hate them now.
Yeah,
I prefer wine bars. Well, especially in Balham.
Look, John, it's been lovely to talk to you. I've got to go back to Hertfordshire, so it's a long way.
Well,
it
is. I've just got to, you know.
Down to Balham. I miss Balham.
Yeah, I've got to go back to a house that's got £1 million equity. Vote Labour. So. No, it's been interesting. I was really scared about doing this.
I know, I'm surprised about that.
No, you know, I'm not. I'm genuinely not the kind of hard-nosed fucker that a lot of people think I am.
You aren't.
No. But, you know, because, you carry an amazing reputation in the industry, you know, because you're, you know, one of the best comics that Britain has, you know, for the last 20, 25 years I've known you. And the same with all the work that you did with Stuart as well. And I know how amazingly successful this is. And I'm thinking, I'm doing this with Rich Herring and I'm on to Iannucci. I should be marking books. You know. But I've really enjoyed it, and hopefully people would go, who the fuck's he? Would just think, oh, he was all right. you know.
Well, go and see some live comedy.
Please go and
see John doing stand-up. Go and listen to John's radio show when it comes out again.
Yeah, the John Maloney show. I believe it might be March, April next year. That's when it's like penciled to go out. But the other stuff is out there online.
And are you planning to go back to the Fringe? Have you got another show in?
I might be going in August, yeah. Because I'd like to run some live stuff through from the shows. Because there's stuff that's written that was performed on radio, and I'd like to sort of just make it expand some of it more to a new hour. Cool. I love Edinburgh.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. And, you know, it's what you're saying is absolutely correct. There's so many fantastic comedians out there. I'm hoping to talk to lots more.
Yeah, well, every bit of London, you'll find a comedy club. You know, like in Balham, you've got Banana Cabaret. In King's Head, in Crouch End, you've got the Backyard Cabaret out in Whitechapel. You know, you've got the Bearcat in Twickenham. You've got the Headliners in Chiswick. You know, there's enough around. And you just see some amazing people. And then people who are really well known turn up and try some new stuff as well. I mean, of course, when you've got the store here in London, just here in Leicester Square, of course, it goes without saying. But I'm saying that places around London as well, there's still a thriving circuit, you know. And the best of British comedy is out there. So, you know, don't go to a stadium and queue up for half an hour for a warm lager and watch somebody on a video screen, which I'm sure your kind of discerning audience wouldn't do anyway.
They would never do that.
No, they wouldn't.
Do you hear how they felt about Jim Davidson?
I know, they still haven't forgiven me for that.
Yeah.
No, too bad. But, you know, go to your local Gymkhana. Don't go to your local stadium. So, sorry, I'm just trying to find the class of audience. but no, it's been lovely. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, it's John Maloney! You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, John Maloney. The music's by Pest. I would like to thank all the people involved in making this production. Everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, everyone at Go Past the Stripe, everyone at the British Comedy Guide, Ian Tunes, all his mates, all that lot, everyone. Probably forgotten some people. My producer is Ash Caffrey, and it is a Sky Potato Fuzz at Go Past the Stripe production. Thank you very much for listening. Go and buy emergency questions, gofastthestripe.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.